89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So we delve this week into the realm of sacramental archaeology. We know that last week on Thanksgiving there was a new moon, and also Uranus, the principle, the quality of intelligence, accuracy, quality, revelation, you know, increased rates of synchronicity, went stationed and went forward. So the model is, well, we're launching a new story, a new ancient story of kinship. So when I ran across, due to a wonderful listener in Canada who sent me this intriguing article, researchers find oldest stash of marijuana ever. We're going to straighten out some of the misperceptions and mislanguage here. And I was like, oh, cache of cannabis, 2,700 years old, was clearly cultivated for psychoactive purposes. And I go, ooh, this is intriguing. We want to delve again into the history of human cannabis relations. And then I saw, it's an ally, a high school classmate of mine, Dr. Ethan Russo, neurologist and dedicated medical cannabis historian, who is the lead author of the newly published paper. So welcome, Ethan Russo.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
That's wonderful. Yeah. So yeah, and we will. Get out of the way. Many people who read the article go, I was wondering where I left the stash. I mean, all those things. Okay. So we park that to one side and go, how intriguing. You'd mentioned when first contacted you that, you know, Fox News had come up with all kinds of misperceptions and erroneous reporting on this. So we want to, you know, clear up some of that maybe first right away. What was the most egregious kind of five errors in three sentences that Fox was doing?
Oh, well, it wasn't just them, I'm afraid. I've really given very few interviews to date, but there have been so many stories that have been spawned from this, and it seems that with each iteration, someone fabricates a little something new or misconstrues something that came from a prior story. For instance, people have said in these stories that the shaman on whose grave this cannabis was found was blonde and blue-eyed. Well, I'm afraid we don't know because he was a skeleton. It is the case that there were many mummified remains coming from the cemetery where this tomb was found. It is true that the people involved, who were called the Gusha by the Chinese some 700 years later, when they wrote about this, reported that these were light-haired, blue-eyed people. They were not ethnic Chinese, although this was in Xinjiang, the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, which is now part of China. So things along that.
Well, to slip in right here, too, that the Gusha were speaking an Indo-European language related to Celtic.
Yes, that's true. They spoke a language called Tocharian, an Indo-European tongue, which is now extinct, and it is felt to be most closely related to Celtic, to Italic, or Anatolian. And so these are relationships through time that have been woven through various lines of research, both linguistic and archaeological, to come up with what we have piece together as the story.
Yeah, and so I should say also on my website, coyotenetworknews.com, listeners can find the original Globe and Mail partly right story, and then Dr. Russo's actual papers, factual. They are also there as a PDF file to gaze at. And it just begins that the Yanghai tombs near Tupan, autonomous region in China, have recently been excavated to reveal the 2,700-year-old grave of a Caucasoid shaman whose accoutrements include a large cache of cannabis, superbly preserved by climatic and burial conditions. The cannabis was presumably employed by this culture as a medicinal or psychoactive agent, or an aid to divination. To our knowledge, these investigations provide the oldest documentation of cannabis as a pharmacologically active agent and contributed to the medical and archaeological record of this pre-Silk Road culture. Now, this has long been a great dedication of yours, and as I mentioned backstage before we went on, I go, well, 2,700 years old, but in one of your chapters on medical uses of cannabis, you go into 7,000 years ago, the Bileni culture in Central Europe and China, 4,000 B.C. So what's the distinction between this tomb, 2,700 year old, and the known practice 7,000 years ago and 6,000 years ago?
Right. As we understand, it's quite likely that the earlier examples were hemp, that they were a form of cannabis that was used not for its psychoactive properties necessarily, but rather for fabric. Now, we do know that the Chinese themselves likely were using cannabis and knew of its psychoactive properties long before this, and I'm certain that all other cultures used it earlier. The distinction here that I'd like to draw is this is the oldest sample, and it was a large amount, 789 grams, almost 2 pounds, in fact, but the oldest sample in which we were able to demonstrate that this was a drug strain of cannabis and would have been pharmacologically active. Additionally, it's by far the oldest sample of cannabis that's been subjected to genetic analysis. And what we found there was that this cannabis had in it the enzyme responsible for synthesizing THC in the plant, which is called THCA synthase. Additionally, and this was unique, there was a genetic variant of that enzyme that had two what are called single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs for short, so little mutations of this enzyme that have never been reported before anywhere. So if you will, this is a bit of evolution in action with respect to cannabis. Now, in this instance, it was thought by the member of our genetics team, Dr. Mandolino in Bologna, Italy, that this would not have led to a change in the enzyme of any degree, but you understand a little more change may have led to a new cannabinoid different from THC that had other interesting pharmacological properties.
Like what?
Well, it could be anything. For instance, we know there are many other cannabinoids beyond THC. For example, cannabidiol that hasn't gotten much attention until recently because it wasn't, quote, psychoactive. On the other hand, it's an extremely powerful anti-inflammatory, painkiller, and analgesic. Additionally, it's a strong anti-anxiety agent and antipsychotic. So it actually has some effects that benefit and counteract some of the things that THC does. This particular plant sample that we found had minimal evidence for CBD in it, though. It's one of the reasons it is felt, based on the evidence that we were able to accumulate, that this was a cultivated plant. Additionally, the features of the seed, the shape of it, other aspects of it would indicate that this wasn't collected in the wild, but rather it was specifically cultivated. In this instance, because it was a psychoactive variety, I think that we're on a pretty firm foundation in saying that this culture cultivated the plant for such purposes.
And in fact, it seems that all strains of cannabis seem to originate in Asia, right? Yes?
Yes, they do.
And that there are no, you mentioned the word in one of the footnotes, feral, which would mean reverting to wild, but there are no longer any wild or feral examples of cannabis left in the world. They're all cultivated.
Yeah, that's debated now. Certainly in places like Nepal there, or in Kazakhstan, there are places where cannabis grows wild with no interference or assistance, let's say, from humans. But the botanists can't agree on whether this is something that, whether they're really wild or whether they're just escapees from human cultivation. It's just not possible to ascertain. There's also still great controversy about whether there's one cannabis species or multiple cannabis species. It is clear that they all interbreed, but it depends on who you ask. Taxonomy in botany is one of those very difficult disciplines, and there isn't a good agreement. There are different ways of looking at it. There are people that are worried about the morphology, the shape of the leaves, and things like this. There are other people that look at it biochemically. It is clear that there are different biochemical varieties, or chemovars, if you will, of cannabis. But that's a little off topic.
Right, and so maybe at this point, and then I want to come back to the tomb, but it's useful for you to mention that you're a consultant for a pharmaceutical company that's developing whole plant extracts. We want to kind of underline whole plant extracts because so many knowledgeable people are going, oh, what a relief at last.
This is a bit of an interesting story, but I am a neurologist. I was trained in the standard fashion mainline pharmacology, but I'd always harbored an interest in medicinal plants dating back to my teen years. If I might digress a bit, when I was in practice in neurology, after several years, it occurred to me that I was using increasingly toxic agents to try to treat my patients, and often to less and less benefit. I believed that there was a better way, perhaps, to treat people with medicine. And this led me to delve back into ethnobotany, the study of medicinal plants. It is my feeling that plants can be standardized and turned into prescription pharmaceuticals without creating single molecules, but rather, as you mentioned, by creating whole plant extracts that retain the synergy of the various components of the plant. And I've already given a couple of examples in cannabis. Cannabis is certainly a great deal more than THC alone, and it often is the case that medicinal benefits are greatly benefited by having this synergy and combination of plant components. So, leading back to this, in 1998, I became a scientific advisor to this company, GW Pharmaceuticals, based in the United Kingdom. They were in the process of developing prescription forms of cannabis using whole plant extracts, so this was a very natural progression. In 2003, I became a full-time consultant for them, and left my neurology practice. I am very pleased to say that the company is very broad-minded in this respect, and when I came to them with this proposal to study the ancient cannabis from Xinjiang and to offer our facilities for the biochemical investigation, they were quite willing and happy to do it. As you can understand, part of the quality control for making a whole plant extract from cannabis involves doing analyses on hundreds of samples a day to ensure what's in it and that the quality control is there. So the company has great expertise in this area in analyzing cannabis and an awareness of what all the breakdown products are, and certainly the equipment to affect this.
And then just sort of two directions I want to go with that. One is our mutual colleague, Dr. Andrew Weil. Years ago, I've always retained this when he got paid to go around the world taking entheogens. This was 1970. But he said there are no drug-free cultures, but there are cultures with no drug problems. And he likened it, the cultures with no problems had ritual introduction. When you had a caffeine drink, it was in ceremony, and here you are 12 and only in the morning, and the same with entheogenic plants, there was ritual. But he also, the point for now is, he said, you know, when you extract, when you turn anything into a white powder, the difference, say, between coca leaves and cocaine, it causes extreme problems. And in kind of conversation with him, I'd say, well, if we're taking the plant or part of the plant out of its alkaloid context, in a sense, it will only take us out of community. And he said, that works. So the idea of whole plant extracts, and just for our putting on the table, you know, when I get so many calls from distressed parents who say, oh, my kids are taking drugs, and I go, what kind? And they go, I don't know, it's cocaine or marijuana. I go, big difference, you know, whole plant or powder. And just that model that we put on our work table as a working definition to one side, you know, maybe anything, whether it's a thought, a plant, a feeling that leads us to a sense of kinship and greater wholeness, we'll call a sacrament. And anything that increases alienation and, you know, whatever, we'll call it a toxin. So that's why so many people, I think, were relieved to go, you know, the whole plant extract, which they're working on. And then the second part of what you just said is, yeah, in the article, they said that, it took 10 months of paperwork to actually ship the cannabis, you know, to this research facility in England. And what was just a brief nod to that? What was that?
Well, the Chinese officials needed to be satisfied, and the British officials needed to be satisfied, and I can't attribute blame to anyone. I think that length of time is probably the normal course of events to go through the proper channels to affect this kind of transaction. It's a little more difficult than just sticking it in an envelope, but we wanted to do things by the book, and
right, by the book takes longer.
Curious.
Yeah, that's right. So let's go back to the tomb itself. Now you weren't actually at the tomb.
Oh, I certainly was.
Oh, wonderful. Yes, because there are these great pictures again, which our listeners can look at coyotenetworknews.com. This windswept, barren mountain, the Yanghai tombs with the Huayan Shan mountain range in the background, going whoa, windswept, whoa, dramatic. And in the shaman's tomb, apparently he had a leg wound. There were the skull and bones of a female sibling, we wonder. Earthenware pot, leather basket containing cannabis, equestrian bridle, leather medicine bag, bows and arrows, wooden implements, wooden bowl with cannabis used as mortar and pestle, arrows, and a harp. A harp. We love that. So you were there when we don't know who it was, Mr. Shaman of high status was excavated.
Yes, you know, I went in March, after we did all the studies, it was always part of the equation, if you will, that we would get together and resume the field study, because this particular tomb had been excavated in 2003, and as often is the case, they weren't aware of the import, necessarily, of everything they found, and certain things were taken out and graves were filled in after they'd been excavated. I wanted to do such things as redig the tomb and look at the temperature gradient between the surface and the depths of the tomb. We had to explain, for example, how would it be that there was this phenomenal preservation of this cannabis for this length of time? Because under the microscope, it almost looks fresh. The glandular trichomes, or glands, where the cannabinoids are produced, were visible, clearly visible. So this was really something phenomenal. And the answer is that there was this big temperature difference. The day that we were re-excavating, it was pretty warm. The surface temperature of the soil was 36.5 degrees Celsius, so almost body temperature, whereas the temperature was only 12 degrees centigrade Celsius at the bottom of the tomb, so that's around 54 degrees. It's a big, big difference. Additionally, the soil there is extremely alkaline, in the range of pH of 8.6 to 9.1. And between those two factors, we have the reason that there just wasn't total degradation of this herbal cannabis over the intervening 2,700 years.
And so presumably the cannabis was still potent. The seeds didn't germinate.
No, we tried that. That is, I'm afraid, one of the misconceptions that's been reported in the media. We didn't say that it was potent. We said that it certainly was a drug strain, that there actually was just a tiny, minuscule amount of residual THC. However, there were greater amounts of its metabolic breakdown products, its oxidative breakdown products. So the things that it turns into were there in abundance. And between that fact and that we were able to demonstrate the presence of the biosynthetic enzyme that makes THC, that was the clincher. So this was, we don't know how strong it was. We just know that it was a THC-bearing strain.
And we also know that it was from many different plants.
It should have been a pooled specimen. It would be quite unlikely that one plant, the flowering tops thereof, would account for 789 grams of material. It's a lot.
Well, and you also, in the paper, it mentions that there were only female plants.
Right. It is the case that if cannabis is harvested late, one may not see male parts. However, for example, in India, even in the present day, the low-grade cannabis, so-called bhang, often will contain male and female parts, as opposed to ganja, the unfertilized flowering tops known as sinsemilla, in the West, where there's intent to eliminate males. That's a more refined form of cannabis, if you will.
And you'd mentioned also backstage, just for our ever-increasing linguistic etiquette, that you don't use the term marijuana. You prefer the term cannabis. And right. If you could just put that on our work table, why?
Sure. Well, marijuana is a relatively recent, century or so old, but yet obsolete, pejorative, I'm afraid, Mexican term. It's not even used in Mexico.
It's pejorative. Why?
Well, I think it's come to be pejorative. Additionally, I just don't personally find it scientifically accurate to call an old world species by a new world slang term. So that's my particular bias.
No, that's useful. So as you mentioned, the formal excavations were completed in 2003 of some of the 2,500 tomb sites, or they were revealed anyway, and a human presence in the area for some 10,000 to 40,000 years. And then you'd mentioned the extremely arid climate and the alkaloid soil conditions, so that mummification was of many bodies without a need for chemical methods. But we have just a skeleton here. But I just thought it was also interesting that with the many artifacts that you say are the accoutrements, bridles and archery equipment and a harp and other materials supporting his identity as a shaman. I want to actually come back to that. But also we find capers and wheat and grapevines. So capers, I mean, we could also say, headline, 2,700-year-old capers are found. So curious. So just can you just say more about the vegetative matter that was found as well?
Yeah, first the capers. The capers were found with cannabis in another tomb in the area. And I should mention that only 500 of 2,500 presumed graves from this cemetery have been excavated so far. So there's plenty of work yet to do if funding and manpower are available. So if there are any philanthropists with an interest in this subject, we'd love help.
Well, yes, we'll connect you to Ethan if you go to, info@coyotenetworknews.com. We'll connect you right up to Ethan if you're eager to fund more research. But
capers are another mystery. My colleague, Hung-In Jung, wrote a very nice paper about the capers, and he goes through what is the best, most extensive ethnological treatise on capers in existence. They have been used for a variety of medicinal applications. They're not psychoactive. But why they were important enough to be placed with cannabis in this other grave, we don't know. Again, it's just subject to conjecture.
Yes.
Now, with the other materials, we can say a lot. The archery equipment, well, not everyone was a hunter. And similarly, the equestrian equipment, apparently not everyone was an accomplished rider. And the harp, this Congo harp was a distinct rarity. My understanding from talking to the members of the archaeology team were that they've only found less than 10 of these anywhere in the area. We have, most graves had just a body or just a skeleton with few of these grave goods that were designed to be used by the departed person in the afterlife. So this fellow had all these accoutrements and was obviously a high-status individual, and they have interpreted him to be a shaman. Now, one of the key issues, Caroline, is how is this used? And we really can't be sure. It could, two major possibilities seem to come to mind, though. One would be that he administered this to other people as a medicinal agent. And I think people have an awareness of all the possibilities there. The second would be that he utilized it himself in whatever respect as an aid to divination.
And just to pause there, I mean, because this is presumably preparation for the afterlife, the implication of your former statement would be that he would be continuing to be a healer, continuing to administer after death.
Quite possibly, but again,
it's one of those
things that may remain a mystery. We just can't be sure. I wish that we had answers, and maybe further answers will accrue with further excavation in the area.
And did the harp still have its strings?
The part that I saw did not. Apparently there have been others, and at some point, hopefully when I get back, I'm going to have to talk to them more about how it might have been strung and whether they have any idea of what kind of scale they were using, for example. Was it pentatonic or something else? Unfortunately, as you might understand, there was a language barrier there. Most of the archaeology team were not fluent in English, and I could barely order a round of drinks in Mandarin. So,
and then what did people make of the skull and bones of female sibling, presumably found from what DNA of the skeleton?
Apparently, this is a pattern that was practiced by the tribe, and I'm afraid I can't say more, but their interpretation was that this would be his sister. And why his sister not house, I really can't say.
And whether she was killed alongside, you know, as part of his leg wound accident, or killed and then ritually placed in the ground with him, we don't know.
Right, we don't know. And I wish I could clear that up. But as is often the case in this kind of situation, sometimes there are more answers than, there are more questions than answers. And certainly when one does delve into a topic in this kind of way, there are always going to be more questions.
Yeah, and it is great mysteries. It's like a sort of spirit email going, a fragment of a story going, woo, meeting of, you know, cultures, bridges. I don't know if you ever saw the Smithsonian film about the excavation of the Ice Maiden, I think in the Siberian steppes. But that was an interesting bridge between kind of science and woo, because they found this grave completely frozen, which is very exciting because it means everything, is including skin, will be intact. And they all thought in real time, oh, powerful leader, king, man. But the night before, the woman, lead Russian archaeologist, had a dream in which this woman, shaman, came to her. And then in real time, they excavate and they go, oh, it's not a guy. It's a woman shaman with this incredible tattoos and headdress. And it's like, whoa. So, yeah, so these are, you know, scientific, but also intriguing and spooky realms. I mean, you're excavating stories.
Yes, absolutely.
But we're going to be taking a very short break right now. Our guest today is Dr. Ethan Russo. He is a dedicated history of medicinal cannabis use. And if you are very patient, because we have a lot we still want to put on our table, you can call us after break, 510-848-4425, and we'll be right back.
She shook the constellation and dazzled them crossed his eyes. She shook the constellation and dazzled them crossed his eyes. She showered his head with quasar and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Shiny, 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 come blow my shiny home. Jenny, Jenny, come blow my Jenny home. Telegraph my indigo sky ship, make his voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, Allies to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Our guest today is Dr. Ethan Russo. He was lead author of a newly published paper on the Globe headline, oldest ever stash of cannabis found, 2,700-year-old tomb in China. And again, you can join us if you're very patient, because I want to put some history on our table here, by calling 510-848-4425. But to stay with the tomb for a moment, just curious clues with the shaman, the Caucasian shaman found in China, worn teeth. There's photos in one of your papers of his teeth, which are very worn due to, I guess, high fiber diet, and utilizing teeth for crafting was the sentence underneath that photo. What do you want to say anything about his worn teeth?
Just that. As you might imagine, setting the scene there in Xinjiang last March when I did the field part of the investigation, these are the kinds of questions I asked, and sometimes as much as I learned is what we reported in the article and the supplement. But that was the explanation they gave me. I mean, every time they showed me something, when we brought out his skull out of storage, I wondered about that, because this was our shaman apparently died at age 45, they estimate. But as one can see in the pictures that you have online, the teeth were very worn. But it may be that they would hold fabric in their mouth. They made ropes, not of hemp, but rather from Phragmites reeds, and so these needed to be split apart and woven together, and it's often a convenient place to stick it in your mouth and hold it there, but it will wear over time. I don't know to what extent they had grain in the diet. They did have wheat, and they had naked barley, but how much it was pounded, it certainly wasn't polished. So there would have been a very high-fiber diet to the extent that was a big component of what they consumed. But these people did get around, too. I should mention that this area is the second lowest on Earth after the Dead Sea, and it's extremely remote. It's 2,500 kilometers from either the Arctic Ocean or the Indian Ocean. But this lowland area was a place they probably went in winter. So the reason that this fellow was likely a skeleton rather than a mummy was that the archaeologists believe that he actually died in the highlands of the Tian Shan Mountains, where they go in the summer, and that his bones were brought down for interment. How do we know that they went up there? It's 60, 80 kilometers away, but some of the other graves were lined with spruce trunks, picea, that only grow up at a 3,000-meter elevation. So, as you can understand, there are ways to piece together the story. We don't know everything we'd like to know, but we do know a good bit about who these people were and how they lived.
And we know from Chinese reports that, I mean, I guess that's part of where the misconception went out into the mainstream news articles, light-haired, blue-eyed Caucasian man, shaman of the Guxi culture or Guxia culture. And you say, no, we don't know that. But we do know that the Chinese referred to the Guxia as light-haired, blue-eyed, yeah?
Yes, that is correct.
So we go, all right, we don't know for sure, but we're intrigued. Now, so this has been a long dedication of yours, you know, reading part of your chapter on the history of human cannabis healing relationship. You do say, you know, origin in Central Asia, Tajikistan bordering Afghanistan. Most of what we find are cultivated forebears. But then just to dive into some of what you put forward and to keep, you know, kind of orbiting back to the tomb, the recent tomb, or recent tomb excavated by you and your team. So 7,000 years ago in Central Europe, evidence of use of cannabis, 4,000 BC, China, and it's to allay senility. There's a wonderful thing that you have also, a second century emperor use a hemp-based anesthetic during surgery, and you said there's a folk art depiction of him playing checkers while being operated on.
Yeah, I've been told later that it's another board game with a different name. I think it's Go.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I called it checkers, but I showed a slide one of my presentations, and someone from the audience set me straight.
Really? So it's Go, which we know of as a Japanese game about surrounding and things.
I should mention that the depiction in the photo, the slide that I showed was from Japan. But yes, this was the Chinese Emperor Watteau. It's a really neat one because in it, he's playing Go with an opponent, and a surgeon is working on his arm, and you can see a tourniquet. And I'm afraid that history doesn't record who won the game, however.
Yes, right. Well, yes, it's just a great gun cartoon coming to us from second century. And then ancient Egypt, salve to treat ophthalmologic conditions and as a suppository to increase vaginal contractions, you write, presumably, well, we'll get to the childbirth part when we go for childbirth or for erotic increased pleasure.
Could be either. I've also written about uses of cannabis in obstetrics and gynecology throughout the ages. And again, I'm afraid that a lot of the Egyptian prescriptions for cannabis were pretty cryptic. They really assumed a certain foreknowledge, and they told how to combine this and that for a specific affliction. Sometimes the afflictions have names that we can't decipher today. So,
well, we'll get to Hand of Ghost in a moment, which is the Sumerian one, which is very intriguing. But the salve to treat eye conditions. What do we think? That was a salve put on the eyes?
Yes, it could be as an anti-inflammatory, or it
right.
may have been related to glaucoma. We know that cannabinoids lower intraocular pressure, so any of these things would be possible, but again, I'm afraid it...
Right. No, it's just, again, intriguing on our work table. And then you say cannabis inhaled as an aid to childbirth is in a Judean cave 1,700 years ago, evidence of that, and you'd also mentioned that traditionally, and you can amplify this, that cannabis was used to either prevent pregnancy by just a lot or to keep pregnancy once it was in progress.
Yeah, that's a peculiar aspect of cannabinoids. They often have what's called a biphasic response, meaning that they do different things at different doses. It is known that early stages of pregnancy that cannabinoids can reduce uterine contractions, and it's well reported from various of the Islamic medical sources that it was used in this fashion. It was also reported from a Sephardic document in medieval Spain, a similar thing.
So, so again, but there's an example, too. The Egyptians are using it in suppository form to increase vaginal contractions, and yet also taken in pregnancy, it prevents vaginal contractions and miscarriage.
So, right. Okay. Depending on the stage. So early, it seems to limit contractions. It's well established, though, and this was done in the 19th century in standard medicine in England, for example. The force of contractions in childbirth are actually increased by cannabis. So this is an interesting...
Yeah, it makes so much sense. Yeah, again, we're putting it on... And then what is Hand of Ghost? Okay, Hand of Ghost is what it was used for by the Sumerians.
Right, among other things. This one's controversial because I'm afraid, for better or worse, Assyriologists today are very hesitant to state that any plant drug can be identified with accuracy. There is this material called azala in Sumerian and azalu in Akkadian, the ancient languages of Mesopotamia. And this goes back around 3,000 years or more. But there were 39 uses that were documented by this chap, Campbell Thompson. He was basing this primarily on linguistics, however, not just. He lived in the area for 30 years. He studied plants in the bazaars of the Middle East. So he had a very educated opinion that this was cannabis. And this Hand of Ghost has been attributed to be nocturnal epilepsy, and that's a relatively modern attribution. Subsequent, about 20 years ago, I think it was, scientists decided that Hand of Ghost represented nocturnal epilepsy, and this azalu was used to treat that, which is interesting because we know that cannabinoids also have anticonvulsant effects. They're anti-epileptic.
And that's why also in modern use it's used for Parkinson's disease, yes, and to alleviate pain of multiple sclerosis?
Yes, these are, again, things that have been claimed, and we certainly, for the pain in multiple sclerosis, that's scientifically established. In fact, GW Pharmaceuticals, the company for which I am a full-time consultant, that's an approved use by prescription in Canada at this time.
Right. And then just to put on our table, you go into the Arabic physicians, the famous ones, Avicenna, Al-Biruni, Maimonides, and then very intriguing Hildegard von Bingham, very, very famous 12th century abbess, nun, herbalist, painter, extraordinary, you know, she's making a comeback, she's a great popular figure, writes about cannabis, and then it becomes associated with witchcraft, and we go, no, although Nicholas Culpepper and other great herbalists are still writing about it, and then,
right.
Yeah, and then you bring up, well, the suppression, all right, that's a whole other show. You know, why is it suppressed, associated with witchcraft? And then in India, you said it's for tetanus and cholera and also a more peaceful death from rabies.
Right. Yeah, that's a whole interesting chapter as well. I wrote a book chapter in Raphael Mishulam's last book about cannabis in India. It was one of those nice situations where I'd accumulated all this material, and he was putting together this book, and he asked me to write the first chapter on cannabis in India. So what I tried to do was examine the historical documents on its use and correlate those to what we know from modern scientific investigation of cannabinoids. But the cholera story was well documented in the 19th century. A fellow named Aubert documented that, not just in India, but also in Egypt. And the tetanus was a really interesting story. Tetanus, I'm afraid, still occurs in India. There are 500 cases a year, and many of them are fatal. But for the first time in the 19th century, William O'Shaughnessy, who did the first modern scientific investigations, if you will, of cannabis, was able to cure, allow people to recover from tetanus through administration of cannabis, and he learned this from Ayurvedic physicians in India. So he was someone that was open-minded enough to listen to the indigenous people, see how they used the given plant, and then he experimented on animals and then gave it to his patients and found stunning corroboration of these claims.
And also long-term historic use for migraine headaches, for low-grade continuing headaches, and many other things that we might want to just put on our table, and again, for this long history of human-cannabis healing relationship.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, that, more than anything else, was my initial, migraine was my initial passionate research interest and remains so. Although we haven't yet been able to have clinical trials in that area.
Well, let's go to our first incredibly patient caller, if he's still there. Tad and Casadero, are you there?
Usually I associate GW Pharmaceuticals with the ownership of, like, Sativex and on the CAC and the Nikkei on the stock market. And it's a an owned MS variety. So I'm seeing sort of this pharmaceutical exploration of cannabis, but I believe it's to own it, correct?
I'm afraid this is a topic I really don't wish to discuss.
I'm sorry.
It is a situation.
Could you say
I
that
believe again? That you've mischaracterized the situation, but I think that that's really off topic for what we want to discuss today.
Well, you know,
it's an intriguing question, but we've run into a Saturn boundary, but to be explored, but I guess we can't do it now. Right. Well, I guess because that is okay. We won't go there. But Tad is bringing up a crucial thing about what the ownership, the copyright is that's part of where we're not going at the moment. Is that right, Dr.
Yeah.
Russo? Okay. We're not going there now. But Tad, I encourage you to do further research and report on it. That is useful because we are at this point, of course, where you know so many, as you say, respect for indigenous knowledge, long term base of knowledge of healing plants and the environment. And I loved also botanist Stephen Buhner saying, you know, very often he can walk around people's houses and see what plants are that we call invasive species are growing around them and diagnose the illness of the people inside because he says because the plants are showing up to heal them. It is an intriguing and also this theme of democracy and equality and direct access as opposed to anyway. So all right, well we're not going there now, but yes, that's a whole other crucial, I think, domain of research. So what this 2,700-year-old? When did this paper come out? Remind me. Is it just in the last week?
Yes, it was last week.
And what does it make you think? I mean, just the it's part of your long dedication and certainly excavating. But what was the element of kind of mystery and intrigue and supposition and even kinship? I mean, you're kind of extending a curiosity into 2,700 years ago, and there is some connection made to this culture of shamans. And how, you know, over and over again in the paper, it says, you know, there were other accoutrements confirming his shamanic status. So how do you define shaman, and what were the accoutrements that defined his shamanic status?
Well, it's a funny thing. I mean, go a little bit far afield. In 1995, I spent a couple of months with the Machigenga tribe in the Peruvian Amazon, and if you ask anyone there if they're a shaman, they pretty much won't accept the label. However, the word shaman in their language is Serapagari, which translates as he who uses tobacco. And most people use tobacco in a ritual context, all shamans. All of them practice herbal medicine on themselves and their families. So it's a bit of a hard label to attribute. But going back to your question, yes, I was profoundly awed by what I experienced there, have a reverence for or kinship, I feel, with this individual who likely was a healer. I have tried to be subsequently in my life some 2,700 years later. To me, there is a great deal that we today can learn about how our species has lived previously in other cultures, in other places. And I hold the belief myself that we're really no brighter than people were back then. We have better tools available now.
Well, yeah, but then there's Atsi, the remains found in the Alps, frozen, in which, you know, he had his magic, you know, our friend Paul Stamets speaks about, well, many researchers speak about him too, but he had his magic medicine pouch, which your shaman friend from 2,700 years ago had his medicine pouch, in which were antibiotic mushrooms, but then there were also tools that he had, ritual tools that cannot be duplicated, like the sharpness of the blade of the copper tool, clearly for ceremonial use, can't be duplicated now using technologies that we assume they had. It's like, because it's too perfect. So just, you know, there's a lot of what we find out that is also humbling and, I guess, restoring of respect, going, yes, our indigenous ancestors did know what they were doing very much, thank you very much, about, you know, many things that we, you know, seek. In a sense, I mean, when I started off, I said this is about sacramental archaeology. We're excavating story, history, you know, teasing implication, which is maybe not what you do in your scientific writing, but going, ooh, much to learn, connections made now, reverent use of plant. I mean, all those stories are kind of crucial. So your own speculative, I mean, so you put your research into the scientific papers, but as a kind of literary fellow, you know, connecting with these stories, going, okay, more indigenous respect, more respect. Where does it guide you?
Well, it guides me towards wanting to do more of the same kind of work and find out what we can about how these people lived and what it all means. And also trying to piece together the antecedents of this culture. Where did they come from? Why did they come here? We know or can imply just a little bit. For example, there seem to be cultural affinities of this group with what's believed to be a proto-Tocharian-speaking culture from the north called the Afanasyevo from the Yenisei Valley, which would be in Russia now. Their burial practices were similar, and there were some similarities in their goods. They were incense burners. I don't know what they were burning, however. And then an even older culture, Indo-European speaking, from the west called the Yamnaya, apparently there were enough cultural affinities with the Gusha to imply that perhaps that's the way they came from the west and from the north into this area at some point in time. We do know that this particular cemetery was used between 3,200 years ago and 2,000 years ago. So it was used over a long period of time. And while this could be characterized as a nomadic tribe, because they split time between the lowlands and the highlands, it does appear that they were in the area for a long duration.
And just to again put it on our work table, it's revealed in your paper that this Gusha shaman with his 2 pounds of cannabis for the afterlife, it was not smoked. There was no evidence of pipes. So now we go back to the Chinese use of tinctures, and again something that you're currently working on as well, you know, whole plant tinctures or teas.
Well, we don't know in this respect. It's certainly possible. We know that the Scythians to the north, who were also horsemen that used cannabis, that they did burn it, and that's been proven because of the Pazuric tombs in Siberia that Rudenko found. They date back to about 2,400 to 2,500 years ago. That's proven. It was described by Herodotus in 450 BCE. So that they could have been used that way. It could have been.
And Herodotus remind me what Herodotus was saying about used in funereal rites, or?
Yes, that's exactly right. What happened was during a funeral, they would apparently throw cannabis onto the fire and shriek with delight, as he described it. At the fumes.
I think that's how I want to go. Just a note to future. The wake is good. Well, let's go to our next incredibly patient caller, if she's still there. Stella? She's not there. Okay, so we say hello to Stella in California, wherever you are. That's great. And then also the great use in the Middle East, which much of your chemistry and biodiversity, paper goes. Beautiful. Beautiful pictures, and again, I should mention that at coyotenetworknews.com we have Dr. Rousseau's PDF files, chapters that you can download and go, okay. Yeah, spasticity and multiple sclerosis. Oh, you say that remains a difficult treatment. That's not...
Yeah, and that is one of the areas that's being used in modern times with clinical trials.
And then what I also like, a rather extensive report on the medical value of cannabis extracts and tinctures appeared in the USA in 1860, a tincture of Indian hemp evened the patient's mood. This was about despair, inertia, and bipolar disease. It's a case of a man with hysterical insanity who displayed episodes of high energy during which he thought himself to be a great inventor, succeeded by times of despair and utter inertia that were likely due to bipolar disease. A recent review examined the likely benefits of THC and CBD in bipolarity with a recommendation for clinical trials. Do you want to just briefly, in our waning moments, put that on our table here?
Sure. Well, again, the thing is that cannabis has been used for so many things, but there is scientific evidence of its likely benefit for so many of these things. It's a feast of riches, what to study. There are all these possibilities, and as I've mentioned, there are different cannabis strains with very different properties depending on their cannabinoid content. So there's a great deal yet to be studied, and I am a person who feels that some of this historical and archaeological evidence can help direct us in the future.
Yeah, because in a sense where we depart into the speculative mythological, the healing aspect of cannabis, oops, we're already or on our way out, is clearly to heal the soul as well as the body. But thank you so much, Dr. Ethan Rousseau.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. We will continue this conversation in myriad forms, absolutely, all the things that were brought up. I'm Caroline Casey. Thanks very much to Rebecca in D.C. and Erica Bridgman in Berkeley. And again, go to coyotenetworknews.com for more information on all of this. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Tammy Hall, and I'll be performing at the KPFA Crafts and Music Fair on Sunday, December 14th at 12 noon. I'll be joined by singers Rhonda Benin, Kenny Washington, Kim Nally, and some other special friends. The fair is open from 10 to 6, so come on down to the concourse at 8th and Brannan in San Francisco on December 13th and 14th. Shop for unique handcrafted artworks, sample delicious food and beverage, and enjoy the live music all day long. This event is wheelchair accessible with discounts on admission for seniors and disabled. Get all the information you need by logging on to kpfa.org or call 510-8